Please enjoy this encore presentation of Unreserved, if you dare. Danse Anin Buju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. It's the spooky season. Time for jack-o'-lanterns, tons of candy, and stories to terrify. And if you think witches and goblins are scary, wait until you hear these stories.
So there's some full moonlight coming in through the windows, and I could see just enough. And I made my way through the basement. I opened a door, and it was like the air got heavy or something. It was just a weird feeling. I kind of had to force myself up the stairs.
You know, the sun would be starting to set. You would see a woman walking along the shore, just looking lost. But the moment you started to get close to her, she disappeared.
The dogs became quiet. Their ears were up. Their hair was up. They never made a sound. All they did was stare at this tree. The young man and his uncle, they didn't want to look at that tree. They didn't want to see what was there, but they had no choice.
Today, Indigenous tales of spirits, wendigos, and mischievous monsters. No one tells a terrifying tale quite like Richard Van Camp. And it's no surprise, the Tlecho Dene author from Fort Smith, Northwest Territories, grew up listening to ghost stories seated around a campfire and getting scared stiff by 1980s horror movies. I can just picture a wee little Van Camp trying to be brave, but maybe hiding under a blanket during the really scary parts. He loves the creepy, the chilling, and the lessons these eerie stories can tell us. Richard, welcome to Unreserved.
Masicho, Rosanna, I'm so grateful. Thank you for having me. Are we sure we want to do this to Canada?
Yes, absolutely.
So, Rosanna, can I just frame myself in this? So I just want to say a huge edante, sagya masi, my friends. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm grateful to be here. You know, I'm a child of the 80s, born in September 8, 1971, Treaty 8 country, Fort Smith, Northwest Territories. Growing up, we had the best of G.O.D., the great outdoors, the best of culture, community, connection, family, stories, ghost stories, spirit stories. And then when we'd go, for some reason, with venturers and cubs and scouts and everything else that we were involved in with the Friendship Center, the culture camps, back to the land, winter camps, sooner or later, it would be around a potbelly wood stove and a 14 by 16 canvas tent frame. I just remember that often that would be the end of a good night for me, where someone would finally tell either a wee to go story or a ghost story, or for some reason the goat man found his way up to Fort Smith, Northwest Territories. And you know, to this day, people want to know, like, why don't you, you really don't like camping, do you? And it's because I can trace it back to these stories around the campfire growing up in Fort Smith, Northwest Territories.
Let's talk about sitting around the campfire. Can you recall an experience that just got too scary for you?
Well, okay, so I...
You can do it, man. I'm here. I'll hold your hand. Here.
You've always been the strong one in this family, Rosanna. So, you know, I like to spruce it up. I like to stretch the truth every once in a while. Hey, but this is all true. So what happened was, a long time ago, I must have been 11, a bunch of us must have been 10, 11, and 12. We're sitting around a campfire, Pine Lake, Wood Buffalo National Park, Kettle Point. We've got the big fancy cabin with the huge wood stove, and it's all corralled, and there's nice wire meshing windows so the mosquitoes can't get in. We got the whole beach booked. We got, you know, hoagies. We've got Jolt Cola. We've got s'mores, marshmallows, hot dogs. You name it, we got it. They just installed the floating dock. It's just going to be a great day tomorrow, but it's night. And there's about, I don't know, 12 or 13 of us huddled around this little campfire. And we're telling Weetago stories. And we're telling little people stories. And we're telling Sasquatch stories. And then somebody, as you know, pulls out the Ouija board in a story and everyone gets really scared. And all of a sudden, as we're telling these stories and it's getting darker and darker, and the northern lights are just coming out to play, and there's a little bit of sparkling in the sky. Venus is there. That's Oginans in Bush Cree. Oginans is out in the sky. And then Kalaza, which is the moon, Chipoyan, is out in Naka. Northern lights are out dancing above us. We're telling these stories. And all of a sudden, Junior Mercury stands up and points with his mouth wide open. His eyes are as big as pie plates, people. He yells at the top of his lungs, "The devil! The devil's here. The devil's watching us. Oh my God, the devil's right there."
No. Oh no.
We all go running and screaming up the beach, screaming for our very lives, screaming. Soul throttling screams, and we get into this, you know, the warden's station, where it's all you have to pay $250 a night for this big camp thing. We shut the door, we pull out our little pocket knives, our Swiss Army knives. We ended up sleeping in a circle with our backs to each other like muskox, and we were trying to remember the Lord's Prayer and Hail Mary. And we were mad because we were white-knuckle Catholics. You know, we're barely holding on. And we're like, what are the prayers? What are the prayers? And we were crying. We were scared. And we kept saying, "Junior, are you sure it was the devil?" And he goes, the horns, beard, the eyes. There was fire in the eyes. It was the devil. And the devil was watching us and listening to us. And I think he knows all our names. And we were, that was it. So we ended up falling asleep with our backs to each other. And in the morning, I remember this bus driver showed up to bring food, to bring breakfast. And we all ran onto that bus. And we said, "We're done. We're going home. That's it. Take us home." And he tried reasoning and saying, "You guys are supposed to be out here for another night." And Junior Mercury said, "No, no, because the devil's here." And the bus driver was like, "I'm sorry, did you say the devil?" Yeah. He goes, "Let's go, boys." So we grabbed all the instructors who had slept through the whole, they had no idea, they had their own little tent. So we all get on this bus. We're in, like, we cannot be consoled. We're praying. And we're like, "Right, just maybe stop at the church on the way back to town."
Pick up some holy water and spray it around. And
the bus like, "We're going, well, yeah, we got to go to the church. If you guys saw the devil, right, he probably knows my name too." So as we're driving away, somebody, probably Bernie Bergman, you know, wildlife officer, goes, "Boys, would that be who you saw last night?" And we looked, and here it was, a bull buffalo. So that's what Junior saw. And it makes sense because it was pitch black. You know, this buffalo pushes its massive head through these, you know, spruce trees, pushes them aside to see what's going on. And that's what Junior Mercury saw. And I tell you, we still can't joke about it. It's, the wounds run too deep to even laugh. You can laugh your head off, but at the time, I mean, to fall asleep in fear holding your dad's Swiss Army knife with your back, you know, to your friends, that I think was the first time I knew full soul throttling terror.
Was it a buffalo? Really?
It was a buffalo. It was right. A buffalo. Lie to me if you have to. No, but it was a buffalo. And I'm 51 now, and we can kind of sort of joke about it, but just the terror in all of us. I think it bonded us as brothers.
Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. And as you grew to be a big Richard Van Camp, traveling around the territory, listening to more scary stories, because apparently you just can't get enough. What are some of the scary figures from Indigenous cultures that you've heard about across Turtle Island?
So growing up, of course, we heard about the Naga, the Sasquatch, the tall ones, which we hold in high regard. We ended up hearing about the Weetago. We had a really scary thing happen. You know, a long time ago, I was working for the Dene National Office in Yellowknife, and I was in charge of their library. And I discovered a little article about Fort Fitzgerald. It's a recounting from an elder that a long time ago in Fort Fitzgerald, Alberta, when the workers were unloading the barges, a young man went down there to go and help out and earn some money. And as he was walking down, they had someone chained face down to a hill. And as they were walking, of course, they'd never seen anything like this. They looked, and a man came up and said, "Don't look at it." Well, of course, you're a young man. You get past the first guard, and he peeked left. And this person that they had chained to the hill was chained face down, crucifix style, with someone standing over them with a big stick. And this person looked, and this being that was chained face down on the hill looked up, and they met eyes. They met each other's eyes from a distance. And this man who was recounting this story fainted. He actually felt all of his strength being pulled from his body as this being raised its hands just a little bit off the earth. At that point, the man with the stick that was standing over this being started hitting it to put its face down. And they said, "That is a Wendigo. That is a Weetigo." They were transporting a Weetigo down where it could be cured, where it could be doctored.
Of course, your Weetigo story scared the heck out of me when I was reading them, just the little short story ones, and they were terrifying. And for Canadians who don't know, are a hungry spirit. They are greed. They never are sated. Did I sum it up?
Absolutely. They usually start. They usually start with their own fingers and the inside of their own cheeks, and the hunger. The more you eat, the hungrier you become. The more you drink, the thirstier you become. And I think we live in the time of the Weetigo, right? We live in a time of incredible greed where logic and human compassion no longer apply. So the Weetigo is a perfect metaphor for what's happening now.
Yeah. And it does more than scare you. I mean, these are stories that are not meant just to scare you. There's some valuable lessons, right? What kinds of teachings did we hope to pass on with these kinds of stories?
Well, I think it's listen to your elders. There's a reason elders and knowledge keepers are sharing these with you, because there is evil in the world, right? There are children hunters in the world. There are women hunters in the world. There are people who are born who just love killing, mm-hmm. right? There's no negotiating. That's just how they were born. And so these stories that are shared teach you respect for things and an understanding of things, and a good listener really starts to understand that there's a reason people are telling you these stories. So be careful. Be careful on the land, on the water, be respectful, do your best, do no harm, and hopefully no harm will come to you. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. You know, when you were growing up, were you told, Rosanna, that when the streetlights come on, you come home?
Yep.
Yeah, same. That's exactly here in Edmonton with our little one, now that our little one is 8, you know, when those streetlights come on, Daddy's going to come get you, and I'm going to take you home, because mm-hmm. it's dark now and we want you safe, right? And I think maybe these stories are designed to keep us safe.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Now, in some Indigenous communities, and we alluded to it earlier, there are rules and protocols telling these stories. For example, the Weetigo stories told when there's snow on the ground or when the wind is howling. What other kinds of protocols are you aware of when telling these or sharing these scary stories? Ownership is a big one. Whose story is it?
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, there's many stories that I don't have permission to share. But here's what I learned. And thank goodness I learned it early. And I think it all started at the supper table when we would have visitors. Mm-hmm. And that is when you share a story, whether you're publishing a book or sharing a story, you're actually firing an arrow of light into the world. And we don't know where that's going to end up. We really, really don't. So assume that one day somebody is going to come to me, let's say, and say, "Who gave you permission to share that story of how to kill a Weetigo?" And to which I will reply, "I'm so glad you've asked, because I have permission from these elders. They've been paid, they've been gifted, they've been fed, they've been honored. And those elders will stand with me and say, Richard Van Camp came to us with a good heart for permission to share these stories." Mm-hmm. And he shares these stories with our permission because the world needs to know how to defeat this wickedness. And if we don't pass these stories forward, we're going to keep inviting them back.
Yeah, I'm glad we talked about that, because I think it's so important to get permission from our elders and our storytellers and our aunties and our uncles. Thank you for the stories that you've shared with us. It's always a good time hanging out with you.
Anytime you want to gossip, you're going to leave with the perm. There's a whole lot of hot air flying around from good old Van Camp.
Richard Van Camp is a Tlicho Dene author and Unreserved's pop culture uncle. We reached him in Edmonton. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild, your spooky cousin. We did worry about sharing this next story, but as Richard Van Camp said, there is snow on the ground in many parts of the country. Beware, this story gets pretty graphic and kind of gruesome. It's not for the faint of heart, or for your little ones. So gather round, brave listeners, for a chilling tale from Anishinaabe artist Isaac Murdoch.
I'm going to tell you something that happened a long time ago. This story was told to me by a very old man. His name was Miss David. And the story that he told me is called Otsukan. So many years ago, his uncle was traveling with an older person. And of course, back in those days, in the wintertime, they always traveled by dog sled or by a snowshoe. One day, they both had weird thoughts enter their mind. These thoughts were not regular thoughts. In their mind, they wanted to eat each other, but they didn't say anything. And of course, as the day moved on, they were getting scared for nighttime. As we all know, that's when all the bad things happen. That's when the spirits are out. That's when they're most active. So they were scared that maybe their bodies was filled with a spirit. Maybe something was inside of them making them want to do this. But again, they didn't tell each other. But as nighttime approached, the older gentleman said, "Something's not right. I have a craving that I want to eat you, my nephew." And the nephew said, "Me too, but I don't know why." Boy, that young man was scared. He said, "What do we do?" The old man said, "I don't know. I don't know. But let's put our offerings in the fire and ask for help because something's not right." So of course they had a wood stove where they were. They were in a tiny little cabin. Oh, they put their offerings in the fire of food. And they asked the Jibayagok, the spirits, "Come and sit with us tonight so that we don't eat each other. Something's not right. It's not our own power making us do this." All of a sudden, this real bad stink came. It was blowing in from the north. It was all outside. It was all in the cabin. You could just smell it. Not a regular kind of a stink, but one that smelled like dead bodies. It filled their nose. So they took some of the moss out of the cracks between the logs and they shoved them in their nose so they couldn't smell the smell of death. And they were scared. The old man said, "We must leave right away. Something's coming." So, of course, they got their dogs ready and they started going down the trail. As they were going down that trail, things looked different. The trees looked different. They looked bigger than normal. There were things in the forest, like shadows, that didn't make sense. And that constant push of that smell was going into their mouth. It was going into their eyes. That smell was so bad, it was burning their ears. So they had to put moss and stick it in their ears so that smell wouldn't burn their ears. And not only that, but that feeling of wanting to eat each other was so strong. But they kept going. They had to go through that trail to get to the lake. Once they got to the lake, the fresh air would come in and blow some of that badness away. But as they were going through that trail with their dogs, all of a sudden, The dog stopped. Something was horribly wrong. The dogs became quiet. Their ears were up. Their hair was up. They never made a sound. All they did was stare at this tree. The young man and his uncle, they didn't want to look at that tree. They didn't want to see what was there. But they had no choice. They looked at it, and there it was, standing sideways on a tree, was a man. Not a regular man. This man had a heart made out of ice, and he stunk. He was bigger than normal. And guess what? He didn't have any lips. He chewed them off his own self. And he looked at those two men, and he spoke real good Indian. And of course he said, "Ah, Nui Sin, I'm gonna eat." Those two guys didn't know what to do. So the uncle had a .22. He shot it right in the back of his ear. That thing fell out of the tree, and it got up, and it started going after that boy. It got to him, and he grabbed his face, and he started chewing on his face, on his side. That boy was paralyzed. He couldn't do nothing. The powers of that powerful man was too strong. Well, the uncle grabbed an axe, and he snuck behind that monster, and he hit that monster in the back of the head, and that monster fell over. What that monster didn't know is that uncle was a very powerful medicine man too. Very powerful. He fasted all winter underneath the ice to get his power. His uncle had special powers and started to fight with that monster. They fought back and forth, back and forth. As the uncle started to make that monster bleed, the more crazy that monster got, but the more power he got. He noticed that boy on the ground. Half his face was gone. How could he ever survive? But the uncle had to try. So the uncle kept fighting, and was finally able to cut that monster's head off with an axe. He started to chop it up, starting with its fingers. Then he gutted that man all the way from his throat, all the way down to his belly button. He reached in there and he took out that monster's heart. It was ice cold. But that monster was still alive. Even though its head was chopped off, it was talking and talking and talking. And all of a sudden that head started to roll around. And it started to eat its own self. All the body parts that were chopped up, it was rolling around that head. It started to eat those things. Fingers. It started to eat the liver. Its own liver. But it was really trying to roll towards that boy. So the uncle kept chopping that thing up into little pieces and made a big fire. Threw all those pieces in there. But before he threw the head of that monster in that fire, he grabbed a big black stone. He put it in its mouth and he kicked it in there so it couldn't talk. He grabbed stones and he shoved them in its eyes so that it couldn't see. And then it grabbed sticks, shoved them in its ears so it couldn't hear, and threw that head in the big fire. Of course he was a powerful medicine man. Of course he knew how to cure that boy. But he wasn't trying to cure the boy of the wounds on his face, but the saliva that got into that boy's bloodstream was going to turn that boy into one of those monsters too. So he bandaged up the boy, he stopped the bleeding quickly. But at that spot, he had a shaking tent. They call that Jiskan. He made a Jiskaning, and he had a ceremony in there to bring in the spirits. And sure enough, the spirits came. And for 4 nights, he burnt that body. And for 4 nights, he tried to drive that evil spirit out of that young boy. That monster was strong. Even on the fourth day, that head was still rolling around trying to spit out that rock. The fingers were still moving in that fire, trying to figure their way out of the fire. Even the heart wasn't even unthawed. Finally, all of a sudden, the winds changed from a north wind to an east wind. That's always a good sign. That's a sign that the great power of Wabano is coming, the great power of light. That fire started to burn down, and it completely burnt the body of that monster. So this great medicine man got some stones, big ones, and he placed them around that fire. And he instructed those stones. He told each and every one of those stones, protect my people from this monster. Guard this bad spirit here. Talk to the trees. Get them to throw their branches and their leaves on you. Because of course, if somebody was to go there and remove one of those stones from that circle, that bad spirit had the power to come back. So that's how it was left. The boy survived. The boy grew to be an old man and told the story to his nephew, who then told that story to me. And that's what really happened a long time ago. And they say that there's a reason for that. You know, our people, in order for us to survive, we have to share our food. We have to work hard for our food. When we don't give offerings, when we don't give to those spirits, it affects the natural laws and it can cause starvation. And when starvation starts to happen, that's when those bad spirits come to prey on the people. So that's why it's so important. I offer this tobacco, mijam, for this food. That's how we keep those bad spirits away, by always giving our offerings, by always sharing what we have with everybody. The medicine we seek is in the offerings that we give. And that's the story that I wanted to share with you.
That was Isaac Murdoch sharing a story of the Wendigo. Isaac is an Anishinaabe artist, storyteller, and musician from Serpent River First Nation. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild, the cousin who takes a 10% candy tax for my kid's Halloween bag. Julie Pellissier Lush is a poet. In fact, she was Prince Edward Island's first Indigenous poet laureate. You might wonder, what's scary about poetry? Nothing, unless you're Edgar Allan Poe. But Julie is also part of a group that explores the paranormal on PEI. And she recently published a book about the spirits that remain after death, still wandering the shores of the island.
Well, there is so many stories here in Mi'kma'ki, but the one that comes to mind right now for me to share is a story about a young girl and her mother and her father. Now, this was a long, long time ago. When they first came to PEI, they moved to St. Peter's, which is probably around the central eastern part of PEI. Now, the father ended up getting very, very sick. And she had made friends with the Mi'kmaq people in that area. And they attempted to try to help him, but he didn't survive. And after a little bit of time, she realized, her and her mom, that they wouldn't be able to survive there on their own for very much longer. So they ended up moving down to the south beach here on PEI on the eastern side, 20 minutes down from Charlottetown, which is the capital of Prince Edward Island. And they moved down there to a place called Fort Amherst, Port Lajoie. Skamagan is the name of this area. And there was already a group of British people that had colonized that area, and they lived there and they were doing fairly well themselves. Now, shortly after they moved there, the mother ended up starting to get very, very sick. She was only about 16 years old herself. Now, when her mother started to get sick, the Mi'kmaq people sort of stepped in and helped her. They would bring her food to her place every day so that she wouldn't have to worry about going hungry. And then eventually her mom did up ending up passing away. Now, the story goes that as she was there and she was spending a lot of time with the Mi'kmaq there, she ended up falling in love with the chief's son. And they had this beautiful love affair, all innocent still, but very, very passionate. And they loved each other, and they couldn't wait for the day that they would open their eyes in the morning and be able to spend time together. Well, when the people in the nearby community were watching this young girl, I think there was a lot of jealousy that ended up happening, a lot of jealousy. People were not happy that she was doing so well. It's almost like they wanted her to fail or to starve to death or something, but it wasn't good. It wasn't good at all. So the women started to talk about her, and they started to say things like, I bet you she's a witch. I bet you there's a whole bunch of other things that are happening that we don't even know. The men also started talking at the same time, saying things like, she's bewitching me. Every time I see her, I want her. So the story kept growing and growing about this beautiful young woman who lived by herself down there. Now, as this story started to grow, the people started to get more angry towards her and more defensive towards her. Finally, they went to the local priest that was in the area, and they told him they wanted to take her to court and charge her with witchcraft. And the priest was really not 100% convinced about this at all, because he knew everybody in his area and he was familiar with her. So he went along with it to a degree, because there were so many of the community that wanted this to happen. He knew his position there would probably, in fact, be in jeopardy if he didn't support these powerful community members in his area. So yes, they ended up going to the law, and they ended up taking her into custody. They charged her with witchcraft. She denied it, emphatically denied it, that she was not in fact a witch. And the Mi'kmaq people at the time, having lost so much control of their land and everything, they didn't have a strong basis to really support her the way they have always been doing since her mom passed away. Eventually, the court actually decided that she was, in fact, a witch. So her sentence was to be burned at the stake. So right down there in Skamagan, they set up a cross, they lit a fire under her, and they burnt her. She was the very, I think, first and last person on Prince Edward Island here burned as a witch. Now, right next door to Skamagan is our First Nations community called Rocky Point, where my cousin lives. And she's about my age, around 50. Now, every time when she was growing up, you know, the sun would be starting to set, you would see a woman with long black hair walking along the shore, just looking lost. But the moment you started to get close to her, she disappeared. Now, they say that they erected a cross in the spot where the witch of Fort LaJoie was buried, but nobody's been able to find it yet. But we know about the area that she took her last breath, and that is right around the area where the residents of that First Nations community still live. And they know that this woman is a presence in their community, because everyone in the community has seen her at one point or another. My cousin recalls a day where her daughter, who when she was very young, called out thinking her mom was walking behind the house. So she called out, you know, mom, mom, what are you doing? Where are you going? And this figure just kept walking. And then her mom came out of the house and said, hi, honey, what are you doing? And she looked, and the figure was gone. And that figure still walks around Rocky Point and Skamagan, looking for, in my opinion, her lost love. Now, Now, the clicker of this whole story is the fact that that priest, eventually he got older and he passed away. And when the people came to look after his remaining stuff that had been left in his room that he stayed, they found a Bible. And in the back of a Bible was a hidden sleeve. And when they opened it, they found a note. And in that note, it said that he honestly did not believe that Marie Granville was in fact a witch, and that he was just afraid for his job, and he prayed for forgiveness in his letter. So when you think about the witch of Fort La Joie, you just have to think that, you know, sometimes there's more in a story than just a dark, shadowy figure walking along the shores at night on PEI.
Julie Pellissier-Lush is a Mi'kmaq storyteller based on Prince Edward Island. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Would you ever spend a night in a haunted house with its creaky floorboards and strange, unfamiliar shadows? What would you do if you saw something you couldn't explain? These are questions members of Six Nations Investigating Paranormal Encounters, or SNIPE, have to ask themselves. And Artie Martin's first night out with SNIPE left him with even more questions.
Several years ago, I was asked to help out this ghost crew, SNIPE. At the time, I was videotaping lacrosse games, doing it for the local teams around here. And so I was approached by this guy. He asked if I could come out and help with some videos. So I had heard about SNIPE at the time, but I wasn't sure about it. But at the same time, it was like, I would love to do something like that. That's crazy. Plus two, at the time I was learning Mohawk, Gunyagiha. And the opportunity that they were giving me was to go to the Mohawk Residential School in Brantford, also known as the Mush Hole. And if you know anything about residential schools, it's a lot of abuse and a lot of stories of abuse. A lot of trauma has been there through there. My family has been through it. Horrible atrocities happened at residential schools. And what we were going to do is ghost hunt in the Mush Hole. So I end up getting there late. It was still lacrosse season, so maybe August, and it was dark and it was a full moon and everybody was already in there. I never even met these guys yet. I went in probably 11 o'clock and I was already familiar with the place. Like I've been there, I've been through it. So when I got there, I kind of knew where I wanted to put my equipment, because they have their equipment and I was new coming to the group and I had my equipment. And the place was completely dark, pitch black. And so I grabbed my stuff and I told them I was there and I said, I'm gonna go set up. They said, okay. And they asked if they wanted someone to go with me, or if I wanted someone to go with me. I said, no, I'm all right. I go down into the basement of the Mush Hole, and I went to the girls' side of the Mush Hole, because that's the only way to access the stairwell on the girls' side, and that's where I want to set up my camera. And I figured I put my camera there because that's the least amount of traffic from public or even workers. There's no reason why anybody would need to go there ever. So I went through the basement. I could barely see. Like I said, it was a full moon, so there's some full moonlight coming in through the windows, and I could see just enough. And I made my way through the basement. And I had already had my tripod extended, ready just to put down, and my camera was ready to go. My batteries were ready to go. All I had to do was set it up when I get there. So I get to the door of the stairwell on the girls' side, and
It was like I opened a door and it was like the air got heavy or something. It was just a weird feeling. I kind of had to force myself up the stairs. And it was like kind of like walking with like a lot of mud on your boots or something. It was just like my footsteps were heavy. And I'm trying to be quiet. And I walked up the stairs. I made it up there. And I didn't want to go any further, so I only made it to the second floor. And then I put my tripod up, and I was really fast about it. And I pointed it where I wanted to look. I checked that it was recording. I checked the sound, and then I took off. And I left as fast and quietly as I could. So the night went on. It was, to be honest, kind of uneventful. It was quite the long night, and we wrapped it up. And I couldn't wait to check what was on that footage. And it was all kind of like, it was all kind of like a novelty to me at the time. Like, oh, I'm ghost hunting. Oh, yeah. The next day, I remember it like it was yesterday, because we were having supper. My wife was cooking spaghetti, and we had sat down. And I was like, and I told my girls, my teenage daughters, let's eat and watch this footage and see what we see. And so they're all excited to watch it. I was excited to watch it. I put it on our TV, press play, and we're watching it. You see me set it up. You see me leave. And then the first thing I noticed was there was a lot of orbs. Well, at the time, Snipe was getting excited about seeing these orbs float around. Like, I guess those could be spirits. I'm not sure, like little balls of energy. But you've seen some orbs go through there. I'm thinking, okay. There's some orbs. I don't know what they are. Maybe it's just dust. I was trying to like think about it. I don't know. Maybe it's part of the moonlight, because the moonlight was coming in too at a certain way. And then I'm just sitting there eating spaghetti. We're all kind of just watching it. And this, it was like this sparkly mist just kind of like slowly appears as it's coming downstairs. It's materializing before your eyes. And then once it hits the moonlight, it kind of disappears into the atmosphere. And my girls, like we all see it at the same time. I'm sitting there looking at it, eating spaghetti. And I was like, what is that? And then my girls, they start freaking out. They're like, what is that? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know what it is. But it was exactly what it was. It was these this sparkling mist coming down the stairs real slow. And then it disappeared. I was just like blown away by this, because it was my camera. I never did nothing fancy to my camera, and I caught this amazing footage. So right away, I start texting these guys. I was like, guys, I got this footage. And they got excited. So I took it over to them and showed them, and they're just, we were all blown away, because up until that point, they were used to seeing orb. And then to see this, this was something completely different. And now we were all speculating, what is that? You know, is it a ghost? I don't know. And we watched it over and over. I even put my camera back there, because we went back to the mush hole a few times, and I put my camera back there more than a few times, and we never caught nothing else. That's not even the end of this, because I start showing people, and for 5 years, I was showing this to people who wanted to see our evidence. We were doing these Whisper to the Moon paddles tours. We would sell tickets, and we would raft people down the Grand River, and then we'd do a little evidence reveal at Pauline Johnson's house, and then we'd do a little investigation with whoever bought tickets. So for 5 years we were doing that, and we're showing all these people from around the world, and we would tell them all about Six Nations and ghost stories. So one day, I think it's called Blog Ontario, this husband wife team, they came down to do a story on us. So we get up to the house, and then we start doing the evidence reveal. Like, by now, after 5 years, this has been a part of our like our story. This is what I'm sharing with them, and this is what gets me most excited, because this is some amazing footage. And this blogger, because he just wants to get some B-roll for what he's doing. He's like, could you scrub the timeline a little bit? So when you scrub the timeline, you're basically just moving the video back and forth. So as I'm telling the story about the stairwell, he asked me to do that. So I scrub the timeline back and forth and I stop it randomly at this spot, like 301. The room just went quiet because we all seen it at the same time. And we're all stunned. Like I was stunned. I never seen it before. But what we all seen collectively was a face in that sparkling mist that came down the stairs. And it looked like a woman's face and looked like she was wearing like one of those habits, like what nuns wear. And it looks like she's coming down the stairs, and then it looks like she looks right in the camera. And then as soon as she sees the camera, she disappears. That night, it was really scary. And it was the first time I was kind of like really, really spooked out. So I was kind of like asking myself all these questions, like, what if that thing knows like it was me and it's following me? What if it's here right now? And how did I catch that? I think it had something to do with me setting up the camera real quick and then me leaving real quick. Then that whatever it was maybe came down to check. Maybe it heard a noise and wanted to see what was going on. Comes down, sees the camera and says, oh, there's a camera, and this disappears. But if it's something like that, then that would mean that it has a conscience. There's some kind of life there or something. And then I start wondering, like, what if it's not a ghost? What if it's something completely different that we don't know what it is yet? Like they always say, like culturally, we're told that the difference between our world and the spirit world is there's a veil there, and it's as thin as a leaf. And if you ever put the leaf up to a sun, you can see some holes in it and everything, and that's how it is on this veil. And every once in a while, we might see something through it. And this one instance, what if my camera caught that looking through that veil?
That unnerving story was told by Artie Martin. He's a Haudenosaunee and a member of Six Nations Investigating Paranormal Encounters. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we are hearing Indigenous tales to terrify and to teach. There's almost nothing creepier than a graveyard at night. What could be hiding in the darkness? What spirits could be lurking, waiting for an innocent soul to cross their path? Well, for Dan Sossaway Jones, a writer and artist from the Ponca tribe of Oklahoma, places like cemeteries are haunted for a reason. And the scary stories we tell about them can serve some surprising purposes.
People use scary stories for a purpose. The medicine people use scary stories and have throughout various cultures, not just American Indians, but they use them to protect sacred places such as cemeteries, burial grounds, holy sites are usually associated with monsters, demons, ghosts, whatever, but they become protectors of these areas. And I'm sure that was done quite on purpose so that these places would be protected. And they're powerful, and, you know, they can work. I think, you know, the young people that are first set off to doing their, you know, their first vision quest that, you know, will go out and spend the first night out in the woods at night, and, you know, they've learned these stories. It takes a lot of power for them to manifest this power within them to deal with what they likely know that lives out there. But the power that they know that will also protect them. It helps create, I think, a lot of power in our folks, in our young people.
Dan Sossaway Jones traveled across the United States visiting Indigenous communities and learning from their scary stories. But he's had his own eerie experiences, things he can't quite explain.
I was building a monument for the children that had passed away at a boarding school in here in Oklahoma on the Kansas-Oklahoma border. And there's a number of Tonkawa Indian boys that were helping me on the work crew, and they had made the pad for it, the concrete pad. Spent a lot of the afternoon doing it and getting it all smoothed out. And it was getting after dark when they finished. So we picked up our equipment and cleaned up and got out of there. I usually cover it up, but that particular piece I didn't. When we had come back first thing in the morning, I was at the truck getting stuff out. One of the young men had come over and says, you need to look at this pad we poured last night. And I went over and I, you know, looked like somebody had got in there and stirred it up or something. We're way out in the country, so there's not going to be anybody around, especially after we left, and especially in a cemetery. And he said, no, he said, these guys want to go home, that work on it. They don't want to stay here anymore. And I said, well, what's going on? I mean, we're going to have to finish this thing. We're going to either put a coating on top of it or something to finish it out. And he says, no, he says, look at those prints down there. And he said, they're human. They're human handprints and footprints. So I started looking at it, and I'm as old as I'm getting, I'm starting to get kind of blind, but I looked at it, and then they looked like human prints. And I, you know, was thinking, oh my goodness, what do we got here? I mean, they were sure that it was children from the graveyard, but I convinced the crew that it was raccoons, and we poured a cap over the top of the concrete and mounted the monument on top of that. I had had a dream that it was kind of a weird thing. I was at the job site, but it was almost foggy then. And out of this fog, this young man carrying a baby in his arms had came up. And he didn't speak. He wouldn't speak. And with him was a number of children. And so I'd had that dream that night that something had gotten into the concrete. So the two things together just kind of make you wonder. I think it's always right here. I think it's, you know, all around us. The supernatural is another part of the world that we live in, we live around, but it's not something that we control at all. If anything, it more or less has more control over us.
Dan Sossaway Jones is a writer and artist from the Ponca tribe in Oklahoma. He is the author of Living Ghosts and Mischievous Monsters, Chilling American Indian Stories. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Laura Boo Bone Stubing, Rhiannon Zombie Killer Johnson, Aaron Ghost Hunter Knoll, and Kim Slasher Casher. You can always find more on our website, cbc.ca/unreserved. Download the podcast on the CBC Listen app or your favorite pod places. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ganaskanamitnawi, Ego Say.